In the fabled land of Northern California, nestled in the Valley of Sacramento, two friends begin a journey to enlighten the world about their experience living life as a Xenial. But what is a Xenial, you may ask? If you wish to know, then follow them on their adventures.
Welcome to the Xenial Chronicles. This is James.
This is Mike.
And, of course, we are still operating in lockdown mode. In fact, California has been re-locked down again, officially as of today.
So we're back on... Wait, is it stay-at-home order?
Some of the counties in California, businesses have been closed up again. So I guess we're not full on the stay-at-home order, but certain businesses have been closed. Restaurants have been closed for interior dining. In fact, there's a lot of restaurants that are setting up in their parking lots, shutting down streets and whatnot so that they can do dining outside.
Well, I mean, that's something. That's better than staying open and dining inside. I mean, it sucks that again. I'm not trying to get, you know. Well, this isn't like a. I don't know, man. Permission to speak
freely.
We'll get
back to that topic. We'll get back to that topic in just a second. Well, I want to take a break real quick. I want to take a break from the topic real quick.
Okay.
I want to do a little shout out. We're recording this on Monday the 20th. I want to do a little shout out to our announcer buddy Scott.
Everybody,
Scott. Today is his birthday. This will be coming out a couple of days after his birthday. But also, I want to say, hopefully, he'll listen to this. You son of a bitch!
Did he share it with
because
you too?
Guess what? Yes, he did. He got it too. It just came up now. That MF-er, and I'm serious. Well, we can call him that now because he's married and has a kid, so he is an MF-er. He got a bottle of blackened whiskey. I guess he got it for himself. He says it's happy birthday to me. And he's got a bottle. He sent you the same picture of the bottle of blackened whiskey. I just got it now. And it's like, fucker, I want some of that.
Right? Damn. No, I'm in the same boat. I'm in the same boat with you, man. It's like, no. Oh, I want to try it.
Yeah.
I want that.
So shout out to Scott. Happy birthday, Scott. But also screw you, Scott.
Yeah. Screw you. Damn. Happy birthday.
So. Can you get back to what you were saying?
Oh, what I was saying. Okay, so permission to speak freely.
Sure. I mean, hey, it's.
I mean,
you
look,
know what?
Man,
it's a free country.
Well, here's the deal. Like,
you have your freedoms.
We have had our agreement to not necessarily get into what we would consider would be political conversations. The two of us have had that agreement for quite some time. This is not necessarily a conversation that I consider to be political, even though it is a controversial one that has been, to a degree, politicized by certain people. I will not be naming names. I will not be doing...
You know what's funny?
What's up?
No, you know what's funny about this? Right before I sat down to get set up with everything for the podcast here,
yeah.
I was making sure I was urinating so that I didn't have to urinate during podcasts.
Yeah, okay.
I also need to make sure I keep myself hydrated. So I have to be drinking something while podcasting because I'm talking and hydration is good.
Yes.
Otherwise, throat gets sore and I have to cough and I sound like I have a disease. And right now, that's a bad thing to sound like. As I was urinating, I was thinking, you know what? We need to address the fact that this issue is not and should not be a political issue. This is a public health issue. And when public health issues become politicized, we got to start worrying about what's happening with politics, because public health issues should not be politicized.
Yeah.
These should be things that everybody's like, public health is important and we should all work towards the best public health.
Absolutely. Fully agree. Absolutely. Fully
and
agree.
That's the thing is, you know, it is a public health issue that wearing masks, even if you want to go with the barest minimum of it, can possibly help to slow the spread of this virus. Even if it's just the can possibly help, even if that's the barest minimum that you're willing to accept. Then to me, it seems only logical that you would slightly inconvenience yourself so that you could possibly help slow the spread of this virus, which has been spreading everywhere. And I mean, it shouldn't be, oh, yes, it will for sure stop. It should literally be enough that it could possibly help, because we're in a society together. We're all supposed to live in this society together and work in this society together.
Yep.
If that's the case, we should be worried about trying to be as helpful as we can to everybody in the society. I'm not saying hand out all your money or your food to everybody. That's a whole different topic, and that does maybe get into political stuff. When it comes to a public health issue like this, if this country had been a little bit more understanding of public health issue and had been more involved in following the mandates of the public health issue, we may be on a better course than what we're on today.
True. And I don't necessarily want to make, you know, this entire episode about this, but
we're just making a little mention here.
Yeah. My personal take on the whole thing is the fact that, look, man, like, I understand the concept of skepticism, especially near the beginning. We are way the hell far away from the beginning at this point. We've been at this. We have been pretty much locked down. James and I are out in California. We've pretty much been locked down, and life has basically been almost permanently changed at this point for everybody out here for 4 months. 4 months. And there has been a lot of stuff that's been going on that is, you know, well outside the realm of reasoning in some social circles, I would say. I'm not going to try to sit there and comment on that. I'm not going to try to lecture people one way or the other. But when it comes down to it,
at least not here.
Yeah, not. Yeah. Look, man, like I try to do what I can to explain stuff. I don't try to sit and make people feel bad for thinking one thing or not thinking another. As a matter of fact, I have praised people for saying that they don't believe in it, but they're doing things anyway because they're being asked to do it by a lot of people. I can understand that, and I commend them for it. I think that's great. At this point, it's been agreed to, for the most part, by anybody who actually looks at it legitimately and studies the numbers and are the actual professionals in the realm of expertise that we should all be looking up to right now, what we should be doing. And we are going to continue to be in this downward spiral until we all of us start acting like fucking adults about it. Really, that's all we have to do. And as soon as that happens, we're going to be solid. We're going to be great.
I'm going to disagree with you on that. We're not going to be solid and great, but we will be manageable.
Okay, I can agree with that terminology. That's more of the key.
Things will be able to be manageable. Things will be able to be worked through. But what that requires is work on the part of every single person. And does it require a little bit of sacrifice? To some extent, it may require a little bit of sacrifice.
Yes.
But the thing is that it comes down to it comes down to the level of sacrifice. What is actually asked of you to do, and you know, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Quote me a president there.
Essentially.
And I mean, what can you do for your country? If all you're being asked to do is wear a mask when you go out in public.
Yeah.
I mean,
stick a piece of cloth in front of your face. That's all you're being
You're not being asked to go over to a different country, have people shoot at you, and you have to shoot at them. You're not being asked to do that. We have people that are asked to do that. We have people that choose to do it. And hell, in our parents' generation, they were forced to go and do it. They were forced to go to, well, if they could, if they, the people that couldn't afford to falsify medical records and pay doctors to get them out of going, or to be fair, the people that didn't go to Canada to avoid going. I'm being fair here. I'll hit both sides of the aisle on this.
Yeah, for sure.
Because if anybody doesn't know, I'm hitting two different major political figures on both political parties that had different responses to Vietnam War and how they got out of going.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and as is right to call out. Like, if we're going to be real about it, as is right to call out. I agree with
that. Yeah, it's appropriate to call out both sides of the situation, just to show I'm not, in this specific thing, I'm not trying to be partisan. What I'm trying to say is, there was a time in living people's history where they were forced to go to a different country and have people shoot at them and them shoot at other people for their country. Nowadays, you're not forced to enter the military. You make the choice to enter the military. But still, your country's not asking you to do that. They're not asking you to put yourself in the way of a bullet. They're not asking you to kill another person and have to live with the ramifications of killing another person.
Yep.
No, they're asking you to wear a mask. And this should not be a political issue. This should not be a partisan issue. Probably the thing that is most frustrating is how much it is a partisan issue and how we have to explain the fact that it shouldn't be. Because even talking about it and you and I being in support of it automatically paints us with a specific color on the political spectrum. And that's sad that it should do that.
Yeah,
because absolutely. Wearing a mask for public health safety should not be something that determines whether you are conservative or liberal. That should not be a determination. And it's scary to think that that's something like that, something about safety and health and the welfare of others is that kind of a political issue. And that heavy of a political issue, it's a frightening consequence of this situation right now with this pandemic.
Yeah.
The
biggest problem that I have with something like that is not necessarily the people that are being illogical about that. It's about the people that would, in any other circumstance, be logical about it. Even if they exist on one side of the spectrum or the other, they would be logical and they would be objective about the possibility of it being effective or not. And then they have to kneel to some political fealty one way or the other. And that's the part that I have a problem with. People that would otherwise make the decision that's the right decision are not making the right decision because XYZ. And
because it's been politicized.
It's because it's a political fealty issue. That's the part that I really have I have a lot of trouble wrapping my head around that.
Okay. I'm going to stop us so we don't get any further because we've made it clear we don't try to get into politics of this. The one thing that I think Mike and I would both just like people to think about is this shouldn't be a political issue. This shouldn't be about party lines and who you're voting for.
No.
This should be about let's try to get this virus under control. Let's try to just even if you're not like Mike said, even if you're not sure if it does help, it's not much to ask to do it anyway, just in case it does. Just in case it helps, it may be worth doing.
Yeah, that's the only purpose. And by the way, I'll just put out an apology for this. We've been at it for a little over 10 minutes, I want to say. If you're sticking around through that, thank you so much for listening. We just want to say thanks. We want to apologize for getting on that soapbox for a little bit. Let's talk about some happier stuff, man.
Well, and again, I think it's a necessary thing to talk about because it's so prevalent.
Yeah.
But again, we're not trying to attack any political group, anything like that, nor are we trying to defend a political group. The only thing we're defending is try to keep us healthy. Try to stop a disease from spreading. I think that's something that hopefully we can all get behind.
For sure.
I mean, when they found a vaccine for polio, they made sure that everybody got polio because nobody wanted to be stricken with polio and end up having to be in a wheelchair for their life. Not saying that there are people that end up being able to have happy lives in wheelchairs, but if we could stop a disease that automatically puts you in that thing, let's stop that disease.
Right.
Same thing. Let's try to stop some diseases. Anyway. To get onto the topic we were originally going to talk about, I was going to let you in kind of on a little bit of a secret thing that has to do with a bit of 80s culture. And 80s culture, oftentimes I feel like the Gen Xers get the claim on 80s culture.
Right.
And then the millennials get the claim on the 90s culture because they're the 90s kids.
Yeah.
And we don't get either one, yet we technically deserve both.
And yeah, we definitely get that cusp culture. We get that.
Yeah. And we get, because we had 80s culture and we had 90s culture. Actually, we had some 80s culture and we defined 90s culture. The 90s kids don't realize that we defined it. We're the ones that in our teen years were wearing all the fashionable clothes and making all the horrible mistakes like, I don't know, the frosted tips in the hair, making all those mistakes. In fact, I was looking at one of those, you know, various meme things yesterday, and it had a picture of Jonathan Taylor Thomas, Devin Sawa, Leonardo DiCaprio, Leonardo DiCaprio from like when he was on Growing Pains and What's Eating Gilbert Grape. Maybe Romeo and Juliet, so actually pre-Titanic, Leo DiCaprio. And, who was the other one?
Did you say it was a magazine or something, or a photo, or what was it?
No, these were memes. Just
oh, memes. Oh, I was like, a meme this just sounds like a cover of Tiger Beat from 1996.
Yeah, no, it's a meme, and it's got, again, in one corner, it's Jonathan Taylor Thomas, like right. Left top corner. Then right top is Devin Sawa. Left bottom is Aaron Carter, and right bottom is Leonardo DiCaprio. And they have that hairstyle that was like parted in the middle and yep. came down to like the temples.
Yep.
And you know what I'm talking about?
I rocked that cut in like seventh grade. Yeah,
you're,
dude.
You're getting ahead of me.
Okay.
You're getting ahead of me.
I have zero foresight into this, buddy. You're just you're giving me what you're giving said, me.
Yeah, the meme said, if your teen crush had this hairstyle, then you probably need ibuprofen for your back. It was one of those lists of memes that you're old if this. You're probably right. old if this. And I showed it to my wife, and she was laughing. She actually didn't know who Devin Sawa was. I'm like, you loved Casper. How do you not know who Devin Sawa is?
Wow.
I know who Devin Sawa is.
Wow.
I mean, Casper, Idle Hands.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know Devin Sawa from Idle Hands, but that was about it. Oh, Little Giants, yeah.
Yeah, he's in Little Giants, the first Final Destination movie. Yep. And, interestingly enough, the Stan video from Eminem.
You're right, that is Devin Sawa. He is yeah. Stan.
Yes, he is Stan.
He's the Stan.
Yes. So,
the real Stan?
Yeah. So as I'm showing her that and she's like laughing at it, I'm like, yeah, so what does it mean if you had that hairstyle? Because guess what? I had that hairstyle too. So because okay. everybody did.
Yep.
But anyway, there's many parts of 80s and 90s culture that are ingrained in us. And that's why, again, the Gen Xers can try to hold on to the 80s stuff. The millennials try to hold on to the 90s stuff. Mm-hmm. We get both. And what was probably the biggest cultural center in our lives during the 80s and 90s? What was the place that you hung out? What was the place you went to get anything that you needed to get? Where was our cultural center? Do you know? Are you thinking about it? Where would you say our cultural center would be?
Are you talking like, okay, question. Are you talking like physical?
Physical, yeah, physical.
Okay, physical.
The place
hangout.
That you would go, the place that you would go to get the things that you needed to get, the place that you would go to hang out, the place where all the cool kids were.
Well, I was kind of semi nerdy, so I hung out with the theater kids, but at least in like high school and middle school.
Well, I mean, you're still hanging out with the theater kids. Right
I know, right?
Now,
yeah, some things don't change.
Some things, yeah, some things don't change.
Man. You're trying to think like outside of school? Because I was always like kind of
yeah, outside of school. Outside of school.
I was an at-home video games kind of kid.
Okay. Well, and by the time I was a teenager, I lived in a place where I lived in the woods. I mean, I lived like 50 miles from the nearest McDonald's. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you live 50 miles away from McDonald's, then you live out in the middle of nowhere, basically.
Oh, yeah. Well, I at least had, I some semblance of access. When I was in middle school, I would hang out either up at, like, Sunrise Mall in, like, Sacramento area, or I would go downtown to, like, K Street. On the weekends and stuff. We'd take the light rail to K Street from Rancho Cordova. I used to live in Rancho.
And K Street is also a mall.
Yep.
And that's exactly what I'm referring to.
Okay.
The mall.
Ah, yes.
The mall is, think about it. Think about how many music acts during the 80s and the 90s got their start as mall musicians. Debbie Gibson got her start there. Tiffany got her start there. I believe Britney Spears got her start in some mall stuff, other than, of course, being on the Mickey Mouse Club. But there was a huge number of mall musicians that ended up, especially pop singers, that ended up getting their start singing at malls. Malls were kind of the cultural thing of the 80s and 90s.
Right.
Well, we have one family that was actually one of the biggest development families behind the creation of first strip malls and then the actual enclosed mall. And what's funny is,
okay,
what's funny is not only did they have their thumbprint or their fingerprints, whatever, all over mall culture, because they basically started the mass production of malls.
Right.
They also have affected America's largest sport. And I'm not talking about baseball.
Okay.
Even though people want to think of it as America's. No, because baseball, so the thing about it, baseball is, while it's considered America's pastime.
Right.
It's no longer really an American sport. Baseball is played all over the place.
Yeah, baseball's international.
If we're being completely honest, there are other countries, islanded nations close by the United States
that
do their best to raise their children to be great baseball players so that they can come to America and make their money playing baseball.
Right.
But baseball is no longer truly an American sport. In all honesty, there's only one real American sport still. Other countries have tried it and tried to keep leagues going of it, but they can't compete. This is America's number one sport, and it's the most watched. In fact, the final sporting event for the year, it should be a holiday. At some point or another, they need to declare that a holiday and make the following day a day off from work for people. Because frankly, it's necessary, especially people that live in the cities of the teams that are playing in the game. Because if your team loses, you want to drink away your sorrows. Trust me. I had that experience recently. If your team wins, you want to party hard and enjoy. And, of course, what I'm talking about is...
football.
Yes, the NFL.
Yep.
This specific family, who were owners of a team for 23 years, and, in fact, got a few records in the record books as owners of the team, something they actually accomplished a feat no other single owner of a team has ever. Because, you know, certain teams pass from owner to owner. You can buy, if you have enough money, you can buy a football team and be the owner of the team.
Right.
Now, this specific team is still owned by the family, just the one specific family member who had this record no longer owns the team because he got himself in a little bit of legal trouble. However, he is in the NFL Hall of Fame as a he's under the category contributor, which is where they put somebody who was not a coach, not a player, but somehow was connected to the game. They don't really have an owner's section for the Hall of Fame. They have a contributor, and any owner that gets into the Hall of Fame will get in as a contributor.
Okay.
But the family that I'm talking about is a family from Youngstown, Ohio. Now, I know at least one, maybe two people listening to the podcast know exactly what I'm talking about just by hearing Youngstown, Ohio.
Right.
And one of them would be Scott, whose birthday it is today. Happy birthday again. The other one would be my father. because he's the only other one who would know this.
Cool.
But Youngstown, Ohio is the hometown of the DiBartolo family.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Now, the member of the family that started the mall revolution was Edward DiBartolo Sr. Notice I emphasize the senior. He owned a construction business.
Okay.
Very lucrative construction business. And they started off building, again, various strip malls. Business centers. Got a really good contract with Macy's at one point and is building all of these business centers around Macy's. And then they moved up to the idea of the fully enclosed mall with all these department stores in them. At one point in time in the late 70s, the DiBartolo family's business owned 10% of the floor space in all of the malls in the United States. So, like, if you take all the floor space of all the malls in the United States and put them into one big number, the amount of floor space that the DiBartolo family owned was 10% of that.
Good Lord.
Yeah. They were huge in DiBartolo Sr.'s fortune was somewhere in the category of $1.4 billion.
Whoa.
from his construction company making malls. And so his family and their company was in many ways directly responsible for the way that we have our mall culture.
Wow, that's insane.
They helped to build the foundation for what we have as our malls growing up, and then what we have even now as our modern malls.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a break right now, okay?
Oh, okay.
And when we come back, you don't know, or maybe you do already, but we're going to talk about what Eddie DeBartolo Jr. decided he was going to do in the 70s with some of his family's money.
Okay.
And it would change the face of the NFL forever.
Oh, man. I'm excited.
Okay, so we'll be back in just a minute, all right?
All right.
See y'all soon.
Hey, friends, this is Mike from the Xennial Chronicles reminding you to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Zenchron, spelled X-E-N-C-H-R-O-N, to keep up to date on all things TXC. And please check out our official website, thezennialchronicles.com, or if that's too much to type, zenchron.com. Thanks again for listening, and now, back to the show.
And we're back, everybody.
Hey, hey, hey.
So Mike, you're going to find out about the DeBartolo family.
Yes, I am very interested. NFL. Let's go.
And see, like I said, this is one family that has had such a shaping of the way that our world has changed. And you would think just a family that owned a football franchise for 23 years, there's only so much they're going to affect. When you consider,
right,
there are some families, the Rooney family has owned the Steelers for much longer than that. Although there is a Rooney rule in the NFL that has to do with the hiring of coaches. I won't get into that specific issue because I don't know all the specifics of the Rooney rule, and it's actually a very politically charged rule. So I don't necessarily want to get into the discussion of that.
Interesting.
But
might want to hear about that at another time. That's
I'll let you know after we're done with this.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, they're actually working on changing the Rooney Rule right now because of the political climate. But what the DeBartolo family did is they bought a NFL franchise. Now, you'd think they're from Youngstown, Ohio. They might buy one of the teams that is in Ohio, the Cleveland Browns or the Cincinnati Bengals.
Right.
I will admit this is just a personal opinion on the situation. I do have family that lives in Ohio, and I can tell you they follow college sports.
Okay.
When they want football, they watch college football. They do not watch the NFL because nobody wants to be a fan of the Cincinnati Bengals or the Cleveland Browns. They just don't. They may be forced to because they were raised there, but nobody chooses to be a fan of those two teams. I'm just saying. But instead, they actually bought a team that had been decent in the 1950s and 60s, but at the time in the mid-70s, they were kind of a stellar team. They weren't doing very well. They bought this team and hired an offensive coordinator from, interestingly enough, the Cincinnati Bengals to be their head coach. Yeah. The team that they bought was the, at that time, struggling San Francisco 49ers.
Oh, really? What year was this?
This had been in the mid-70s. I can get the exact year for you.
Oh, man. Okay.
But they hired, like I said, let's see, 1977.
Oh, man.
Yes, and actually, DeBartolo Sr. purchased them and gave the team to his son, DeBartolo Jr.
Okay.
So, DeBartolo Jr. went out and hired himself.
I was
going to
say, DeBartolo Sr. had his malls and stuff he was building his empire on. He's good on that. So he buys the Niners and basically gives that team ownership to his son?
Yep. Says here.
Okay.
Here, kid.
Okay.
Go play with this football team. Go have some fun. And so he went and hired a great offensive-minded head coach who was originally, again, an offensive coordinator, and hired him as his head coach.
Okay.
That coach was a guy by the name of Bill Walsh.
Oh, I know that name.
Yes, he was the coach of the 49ers throughout the 80s.
Yeah.
He took the 49ers to 3 Super Bowls.
Yep.
He was the coach that drafted Joe Montana.
Yep.
Ronnie Lott.
Wow.
Roger Craig. Jerry Rice.
Oh, dude, he made them the dream team at that point.
He made them the team of the 80s.
Yeah.
But he's not the only thing that made them the team of the 80s. Because you see, back in that time period, the NFL didn't have something that it does have today.
Uh-huh.
It didn't have two somethings. It didn't have free agency. Once the player signed a contract, they were pretty well stuck with a team.
Oh.
Unless the team cut them or the team traded them.
Okay.
They didn't have free agency in the same way.
Okay.
They also didn't have something that we now know as the salary cap. Now, let me explain the salary cap to you, sir.
Okay.
The way the salary cap works is each team in the NFL, in the hopes of trying to give every team an equal shot at getting decent players and being able to have a good team and make them competitive,
mm-hmm.
is basically given a set amount of money they're allowed to spend on the players. This is what's called the salary cap.
Okay.
They're told, hey, this is X amount of dollars each year you can spend on contracts. You can't spend more than this. You can spend less if you want, but you can't spend any more than this. So you can't outbid a team because your owners have more money. You can outbid a team because you've been smart and you saved salary cap money. But this is the most that you're allowed to spend on your players.
Whoa.
Now, there are ways to finagle it. There are ways to give players contracts where they get things that they get money that's not that doesn't necessarily count against the salary cap, like money for incentives if they achieve certain goals, like if they play a certain percentage of plays if they're an offensive player, if they play a certain percentage of plays each year, they may get a bonus of a certain amount of money. If they score so many touchdowns, they may get a bonus. If they hit so many yards, they may get a bonus. You know what I mean? There's ways that they can build in bonuses that are money that doesn't necessarily count against the salary cap.
Okay.
It's not part of their salary. It's bonus money.
Okay.
So there's ways to get around it. And then whatever salary cap money you have left over each year can actually roll over to the next year. So you get extra money. So let's say the salary cap is $250 million, but you only spend $230 million 1 year. That other $20 million can roll over to the next year.
Interesting. Okay.
So what it does is it makes teams have to make decisions about which players they're going to keep and which players they're not going to keep by what they can afford. Well.
Ah, okay.
The 1980s was a glorious time before the salary cap.
Right.
And I want you to take a wild guess at what team had one of the most deep-pocketed owners in the NFL during the 1980s.
The Miami Dolphins.
No, because the only person that they gave a decent contract to was their quarterback, who only made it to one Super Bowl and lost that Super Bowl. Guess who he lost that Super Bowl to? Take a guess.
Oh, did he lose to Montana?
He lost to San Francisco 49ers.
Yes, I'll be damned.
Marino made it to one Super Bowl and lost that Super Bowl.
Oh, that's funny.
In fact, there's an offensive lineman who's being recorded near the end of the game that says they showed up to see one offense and a different offense arrived, because everybody was expecting that Dan Marino's offense was going to be high flying and win the game, and it was Joe Montana's offense that actually ended up winning the game. Joe Montana actually rushed for 2 touchdowns in that game.
Damn.
Rushed. Yeah, he himself rushed for 2 touchdowns.
Dang.
But the 49ers' dominance of the 80s, a large portion of that has to go to Bill Walsh and his revolutionary style of offense at the time. It has been dubbed since then the West Coast offense. At that point, it wasn't called the West Coast offense. It was just Bill Walsh's offense.
Mm-hmm.
The design of which was a combination misdirection style offense, where the purpose was each play to get 4 yards. Okay.
Okay.
Now, I know you know some bit about football, but
yeah.
The explanation I can give you is, yeah, first down, second down, third down, and then if you haven't made the next first down on fourth down, you either have to go for it or punt the ball. Typically punt the ball.
Right.
So if you make 4 yards on first down, right?
Okay.
You make 4 yards on second down.
Okay.
How many yards do you have left to go to get the first down?
You've only got two.
Only got 2 yards.
Yeah.
So if if all of your plays are designed to make 4 yards each play,
oh, you're gonna kill. You won't. I mean, assuming all of the plays are successful, your success rate goes up too because you're playing for 4 yards. You're not playing for 2.5 yards or 3 yards. You play for 4 yards. Then what's going to happen is even if you don't succeed, you're still only going to need technically 3 downs in order to get to the next.
You should
to the next first down. If you're because only if you're running or mild passing, and it's beautiful short distance.
Passes.
Yeah,
they were short passes.
Yep.
And short passes intermixed with running plays.
Yep,
and passes to a running back out of the backfield, where the goal was to get a minimum of 4 yards. Now it was possible to get more yards after the catch or more yards than expected, but the goal was every play should get a minimum of 4 yards.
Yep,
and the idea was you just slowly work your way down the field on these 4 yard plays.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens if you're a defense and they're dinking off these 4 yard plays underneath your defense every single play? What do you start doing? You start moving your defense in. Now, other teams had tried this kind of dinky dunk offense where it would just be a few yards at a time, and slowly work their way down the field.
Right.
Other teams have tried this and had succeeded at it. What Walsh succeeded at was the ability to know when to mix in the short yardage passes and short yardage running plays and the big yard plays. And the thing is, he would have the plays look exactly the same. And in fact, most of the plays that were the short yardage plays, there was a receiver or two running the further out routes.
Right.
And what it came down to is you kept selling the short stuff, and at some point the big stuff released.
You flip it to big, yeah.
He needed a quarterback in there that was able to see when to release it to the big stuff. This was Joe Montana's major skill, is he was able to read defenses super quickly. I would say there's a couple of modern quarterbacks that show a similar skill set. Peyton Manning was able to read the defenses in the same kind of quickness. Drew Brees can read them at the same quickness.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Brady can read them at the same quickness. And Joe Montana was able to see this and was able to be pinpoint with what he was doing. And Montana wasn't worried about being like Dan Marino, airing the ball out all the time and showing how sweet his arm was and how powerful he was. He was about, let's move the ball down the field and let's figure out ways to score. If I see the play, I'll take the play. If I don't see the play, I have the other things to do.
Yep.
In fact, it was even built in. Joe Montana was taught not to force the ball in. If the play didn't work, throw the ball away, go on to the next play.
Yep.
Because then you save the possibility of having an interception or having an issue in that way. Bill Walsh, it was a revolutionary system that combined all the other ways that other offenses previous to that worked. It had power running in the middle. It had the sweep running to the side. It had short passes. It had long passes. And it integrated them all in such a way that they all happened one after the other. And it wasn't just a specific style of offense that, you know, we're a running offense and we throw long bombs occasionally, or we're, you know, we're just a short pass offense. This was all of those things combined in a way that worked fluidly.
Wow.
And it was a revolutionary at the time, a revolutionary combination of things. In fact, so revolutionary that basically every other team ended up adopting a West Coast style offense. And it even had to evolve further, and has evolved further. But at the time, the Niners were on the cutting edge of this offense with Bill Walsh. And the coaches that came in to learn under Bill Walsh were on the cutting edge of this. Coaches that would go on to win Super Bowls with as head coach of the Green Bay Packers. That would be Mike Holmgren. Who was a former quarterbacks coach and then offensive coordinator for the 49ers under Bill Walsh.
Oh.
He went on to the Green Bay Packers as a head coach, won a Super Bowl with Brett Favre as his quarterback. Or Mike Shanahan, who was a offensive coordinator under Bill Walsh and then under George Seifert, who was Walsh's successor as head coach.
Oh.
Mike Shanahan went on to be the head coach of the Denver Broncos and won two Super Bowls with John Elway at the Denver Broncos.
Dang.
I could diagnose the whole coaching tree of all these different coaches that came out of the Bill Walsh coaching tree that learned this offensive style. In fact, the 49ers played the Bengals twice in the Super Bowl. The first time was their very first Super Bowl that they were in, in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And the Walsh was playing against his former coach, and his former assistant on the offense was the offensive coordinator, a guy by the name of Sam Weish. In 1988, the 49ers played the Bengals again in the Super Bowl. And in fact, that was that's the infamous drive at the end of the game where it's Rice Craig, and then John Taylor catches the pass at the end for the touchdown.
Oh, uh-huh.
That's also the John Candy game where Joe Montana calms down the jitters of the team by pointing out that John Candy was standing on the sideline, and that's where he gets kind of his cool and level-headed persona. Like he's in his third Super Bowl, and they have a minute 16 left on the clock, and they're trying to score to win the game. And he points out that John Candy's on the sideline. Hey, look, it's John Candy over there. While they're getting ready to again go down the field and try to win a Super Bowl.
That's great.
But Sam Weish is the head coach of the Bengals at that time. Again, a former protege of Bill Walsh. So Bill Walsh was super influential throughout the NFL and. The people that he taught this system to, and trickle down the system learned from. The current coach of the LA Rams, Sean McVay, learned under Mike Shanahan. So,
man.
I mean, there's, I could go on and on about the
branching out. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, man.
Well, no, the coaching tree, you find so many interesting things in the various coaching trees as you follow them further.
Yeah.
You find out the people that have learned from different coaches. There's like three or four head coaches right now in the NFL that are former Bill Belichick assistants. Bill Belichick being the coach of the New England Patriots and probably will go down in history as the best head coach of all time. We'll see what he does this year when he doesn't have Tom Brady as his quarterback. If he's able to still get himself into the playoffs and get his team pretty far into the playoffs, then the credit goes to Belichick and does not necessarily go to Brady. Brady's in Tampa Bay, so we'll see what happens there.
Ah, yeah.
I mean, Tampa Bay is where good players go to die. although interestingly, the current general manager of the 49ers was a Tampa Bay Buccaneer when he won his one Super Bowl. So that's, I guess, a whole different thing. But, yes, the Buccaneers have actually won a Super Bowl, unlike, say, the Detroit Lions, who have never won a Super Bowl and probably will never win a Super Bowl.
Damn.
Or the Cincinnati Bengals or the Cleveland Browns. So, I mean, sorry, gotta get that Ohio dig again.
Yep.
But anyway, what Bill Walsh is able to do to revolutionize the way that offense works, it still, again, has its effects today. Every offense that you see today in the NFL, it has some roots in the West Coast offense design. Because, again, it amalgamates all these other previous styles of offense. There are a few head coaches that have tried to add on to the West Coast offense and get more out of it. Some have been successful, some have not. In fact, the 49ers' current head coach, Kyle Shanahan, Mike Shanahan's son, who grew up around the 49ers facility and then the Broncos facility, and has worked his way through various football teams as an assistant coach, and been to Super Bowls as an assistant coach, didn't win. Of course, he's been to a Super Bowl as a head coach, didn't win. But his design for the offense takes some of the core parts of the West Coast offense and turns it on its head even further. And that's a whole different conversation about what he's done with his offensive design. He's made it to where, you can do as much with it now as what Walsh was able to accomplish with the original West Coast offense back then, because it's such a twist on the accepted parameters of what an offense should do and how an offense should function.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I can give a rough idea. Again, in previous offenses, you had a specific style of offense. You had a running offense and maybe deep passing, or you had just deep passing. Like the Raiders of the 70s, they were just to throw the ball up and hope their receivers caught the ball. The Steelers. The Steelers, which is probably one of the best teams of the 70s, they won 4 Super Bowls in the 70s. They were a team that relied heavily on their running game, a punishing defense, and then again, occasionally just throwing the ball up there and hoping that Stallworth or Swan would get the ball. Stallworth and Swan being the two receivers from the Steelers at that point in time.
Okay.
These would be pretty prominent names in football. I mean, this is a team that won 4 Super Bowls within a decade. Terry Bradshaw, John Stallworth, Lynn Swan, Mean Joe Green, Franco Harris. These are names that for football people are household names, that, or they should be at least. If they're not, the person needs to go study some football some more and stop saying they like it unless they know all the right names. Just saying. You need to know the Steelers of the 70s. You need to. That's okay. The team of the 70s. Again, if you're a big football fan, you need to know. If you're not a big football fan, it's okay. It's all right. Anyway, the teams had that specific identity. You knew what kind of offense. Like I said, the West Coast offense kind of combined them all and worked them all together. But you still had your set receivers and your set running backs, and you know people still had their set roles. The current Kyle Shanahan offense, the purpose of it is not to have the set roles in the same way that you expect them to be. You know, you go back to that Niners offense in the mid to late 80s, you had Jerry Rice as your main receiver. Do you know who the other receiver was on the other side from Jerry Rice?
No.
John Taylor for a good portion of it. Probably on any other team, he would have been a number one receiver.
Oh, man.
He was that good. And he was also a punt and kick returner. He had in one Monday night game against the Rams, they were in LA at that time still too. He had 2 touchdown catches for over 90 yards.
Damn.
In a single game, which was a record.
2?
At the time. John Taylor was the guy. John Taylor, second receiver.
Damn.
Number 81. The 49ers. And again, he is the one that caught the winning touchdown pass against the Bengals in the 88 Super Bowl because nobody expected it to be thrown to John Taylor. Jerry Rice was the MVP of that game because he had over 200 yards receiving in that game.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Rice was on fire that game, but John Taylor catches the winning touchdown pass because nobody expected John Taylor to get the ball thrown to him.
Wow.
Because that's how the team worked.
Yeah.
The way Kyle Shanahan's team works is you don't have a Jerry Rice. You don't need a Jerry Rice. You don't have a Roger Craig or a Marcus Allen. That's running backs. You don't have the big name at running back. You don't have the big name anywhere on the field. Even the quarterback, to some extent, doesn't have to be a big name. He just has to do things in a specific way.
Yeah.
The point is for everybody, every single person that is designated as a receiver that can catch the ball, that can move the ball forward, because you only get so many of those. You have to actually designate certain people as eligible receivers. Every person that's designated as an eligible receiver should be an equal threat to every other one. And that's the way his system works. They don't want the defense to know who the ball is going to. They should be worried it's going to every single possible eligible receiver, and every single one of them can be put in the right position to be successful for the play.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what kind of a play it is. So it's not like they can double team a specific receiver because that's not going to do anything. They don't have a receiver that you double team because if you double team that person, okay, fine.
Yeah, we just somebody don't else have is
to
open.
With that person.
Yeah.
And so they don't have some number one receiver that's like, look at this guy. He's the big money receiver. No, we'll go over here and we'll throw the ball over here to this person. We'll do this. We'll do that. And the point is everybody should be equally – every single offensive weapon should look equal in the eyes of the defense, and so the defense can't plan around it. This is the way that he designs his offense to work. And then he designs it to where you can have the exact same set of players on the field, and you can have – 30 different plays run out of that set of players, which is not normal. Normally you have for specific types of plays, you switch out players and you move, you know, you bring in a different running back or you bring in the fullback or you bring in more tight ends or different receivers. The idea is all these people can be on the field, and the guy that's normally the receiver, he'll go line up in the backfield as the running back, and the running back will go line up as a receiver. And you have no idea what's going to happen at that point, because the wide receiver is equally adept at running like a running back and catching the ball, and the running back is equally adept at running like a running back and catching the ball. So you don't know what's going to happen. The whole point of it is they should be able to shift all of these offensive weapons to any point in the field.
Right.
And attack you from any point, and you never know where it's coming from.
Right, exactly.
That's what his goal in the offense is.
Yep.
And it's a beautiful thing to watch. If you know what you're looking for, if you've watched enough football, it's beautiful to watch the way he will run the same formation and run, you know, play number one, and then play number one again, and then play number one again, and the defense will start selling to play number one, and he'll run play number three. And it's the exact same setup, and it looks, for the first two or three steps, it looks exactly the same, and then somebody changes their step, and boom, one whole side of the field is completely open, because the defense has been selling on the one thing, and the first two steps look exactly the same as the thing that they've already been selling on. So it's like, oh, it's this again. And it's purposely designed to get the defense to sell, to jump into it, and then boom. It goes the exact opposite way. And it's the whole point of misdirection. You never know where it's going to come from. And that's the evolution of this West Coast offense that was brought in when Bill Walsh was given the reins of a team that was in the cellar and turned them within 3 years, 4 years. He turned them into a Super Bowl champion team, and a team that had the best winning percentage over the decade of the 80s. Moreover, in the 23 years that Eddie DeBartolo Jr. was the primary owner of the team, the 49ers won 5 Super Bowls.
Whoa.
5. No other single owner of a team, with the exception now probably of Robert Kraft. So up until that point, no owner of a team had been able to get 5 Super Bowls out of his team. Robert Kraft has that now.
Wow.
The owner of the New England Patriots. But at that point, nobody else had it, which is why DeBartolo was put into the Hall of Fame. Now, admittedly, he got himself in some trouble, got involved in some gambling schemes, and he got booted out of the NFL. And so he passed the team down to his nephew, Jed York, who is the current owner. Technically, the DeBartolo family still owns it. It's his sister's son who is the owner.
Okay.
So his family still basically owns it, but it is Jed York who is the legal owner of the team at this point and runs the team. Still within the DeBartolo family de facto, though. But to think that now, like I said before, I'm coming back to it now.
Yeah.
Part of the reason they were able to have this gigantic run through the 80s and even into the early 90s was because they had huge money. And there was another team that in the early 90s suddenly challenged the 49ers place kind of on top of the pile there. And that was the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah.
Because in the early 90s, the current owner of the Cowboys, Jerry Jones, bought the Dallas Cowboys. They were sold. He bought them. He fired their longtime coach, Tom Landry, who was at that point considered one of the best coaches the NFL had ever seen.
Wow.
And hired a college coach, Jimmy Johnson, who made a couple of very interesting trades that got a crap ton of draft picks and basically drafted a whole new team.
Oh, wow.
And as a result, was able to turn it into a Super Bowl winning machine, winning 3 Super Bowls in a 4-year span. The only one they didn't win was, of course, the last one the 49ers won. But what you saw during that time period was Jerry Jones had good money. He was an Arkansas oil man. Really, really large amount of money.
Yep.
So he was able to spend a lot of money on stuff. And you saw in the mid 90s, the free agent market become a thing. And in fact, the free agent market is the reason why the Dallas Cowboys lost the one Super Bowl, or did not get to go to the one Super Bowl in that 4-year span that the Niners went and won. The Super Bowl at the end of the 94 season, would happen in January of 95, but it's considered the 94 season Super Bowl. This is the year that they did it. It was the 75th anniversary of the NFL, so they did throwback jerseys. This is when they did the throwbacks with the drop shadow behind the numbers, the most beautiful jerseys.
Oh, yeah, 49ers. I remember those. Yep.
And the free agent market, it was the first time the free agent market was big that year, and they signed a linebacker, Ken Norton Jr., son of famous boxer Ken Norton, who used to be, he actually played for the Dallas Cowboys. He signed to be a linebacker for the 49ers, and then the 49ers paid $1 million, which at the time was one of the biggest single-year contracts ever, especially for the position. Yeah. They paid $1 million to sign Deion Sanders to a one-year contract.
Wow.
When he was a free agent.
Yep.
And Deion Sanders most definitely was part of the difference that made the 49ers have the number one defense. They beat the Dallas Cowboys in the NFC Championship game and then completely and utterly destroyed the San Diego Chargers in the Super Bowl, setting multiple Super Bowl records.
Wow.
In the process. And got Deion Sanders his first Super Bowl. He jumped ship the next year and went to the Cowboys, got himself a second Super Bowl with the Cowboys.
Huh.
But the free agent market started, and what also started as a result was the salary cap, because you ended up having teams like the 49ers, mm-hmm. who had the deep pockets enough to pay their players exorbitant amounts of money
to
stay on the team and not go elsewhere and seek bigger contracts elsewhere.
Right, and so it was just Dallas reinforcing this money-making machine.
Well, it was more of a – it wasn't so much that. It was more of –
Well, I'm talking like as strong as they were, they had the money to do that. And so without this salary cap, you could just sit there and just build upon an empire, because you're talking about you're selling a bunch of stuff. Dude, you got merchandise coming out the ass. You've got
Interestingly, the only team that actually really makes money off of their merchandise. Most teams only make a very small percentage off the merchandise. The NFL makes most of the money off the merchandise.
I have a guess
or
of who.
Whoever, who?
The Raiders?
No.
Really?
No. Al Davis was not that smart. Interestingly enough, the guy who was smart was the Arkansas oil man. Jerry Jones worked out deal when he became the owner of the Dallas Cowboys,
yeah.
where they get the biggest chunk. In fact, they get almost all of their jersey sales. They have a bigger chunk than any other team does. Dallas Cowboys make tons of money off their sales of stuff.
That is a surprise.
Yeah.
That part is a surprise to me.
Al Davis was the owner of the Raiders for many years until his death.
I was going to say he only recently passed away, didn't he? Like relatively recently.
A couple of years ago, like 5 years ago, I think. He did a lot of things to help the NFL move along, but he also was one of the stupidest owners ever. Like, he would, when he was involved in the draft, drafting of new players every year, you always knew whoever the fastest player on the board was who the Raiders were going to draft in their first draft pick. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter what other skills they had, they were just the fastest player left. They would draft that as their first pick, unless for some odd reason they decided to draft a freaking punter as their first draft pick, which they did 1 year. Now, I will admit, he was the first punter to ever get inducted into the NFL Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow.
So he was a damn good punter.
Yeah.
But at the same time, no team drafts a punter as their first draft pick. Most teams don't even draft a punter. It's a weird thing when a team drafts a punter. The 49ers drafted a punter last year, and I was like, what the hell are you guys doing? And then I watched him play, and I'm like, oh, I know what you're doing. He is a really good punter. He's got accuracy. He'll pin somebody right down, like, under the 5-yard line. He'll pin him down good. He gets good bounces on his punts. I like this guy. All right. A good punter can be very useful, but still, it's like your first pick of the draft, you draft a punter. Well, he's going to go into the Hall of Fame. Okay, I guess. all right. By the way, the 49ers punter also used to play rugby. So he actually got flagged for unnecessary roughness tackling somebody on a punt return last year.
A punter?
Yeah, the punter tackled the guy and hit him kind of out of bounds a little bit, but like he laid the dude out, and the punter got a flag for unnecessary roughness, and the team was actually cheering for him. It's like, yeah, okay, it's 15 yards, but dude, you're a punter and you got an unnecessary roughness. We like that. That's awesome. You know, the entire special teams unit who has to run down for all the punts and all the kickoffs and stuff. They're like, you're the guy. He also does the kickoffs, because the place kicker only kicks field goals and you know, extra points and whatnot. He doesn't do the kickoffs to preserve his leg.
Yeah.
So Wisnowski, the guy's name is Wisnowski. What a name too for a punter, Wisnowski. Yeah. Punters always have super long ass names. They got the weirdest names. I'll make you a list to read off. Unless it's like Garo Uprimian, and then that was just a weird name. One of the most famous one of the most famous punters of all time, Garo Uprimian, mainly for his big mistake in a Super Bowl. He was on the Dolphins. Whole different story. If you don't know the story of Garo Uprimian, we'll talk about that one.
Yeah.
But like I said, he does the kickoffs too. So I'm sure that the Wisnowski does for the Niners. So I'm sure that the special teams unit loves him. But again, you have the salary cap in place now that causes this stoppage of spending all of this money to create these dynasties of football. It tries to level the playing field where you have to choose who's going to be your good player or not, who you're going to spend your money on. That's why when you get somebody like Patrick Mahomes, the quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs, who just recently won a Super Bowl and won Super Bowl MVP. was just given a 10-year, because he's a young guy.
Yeah.
10-year, $500 million contract. Now he doesn't get all that money up front.
James?
Yeah.
What is the salary cap?
I don't know what the exact salary cap is for the teams at this point, but I am going to say that he is eating up a chunk of the salary cap, like a big chunk every year.
Yeah, what the hell?
That's basically $50 million a year, and that's huge.
That's insane.
I think the last biggest one was like a $30 million contract for, I think it was either Aaron Rodgers or Kirk Cousins got the $30 million contract.
That's insanity.
The $27 million or so that Jimmy Garoppolo got, which by the way is voidable each year if the Niners decide to step away from, actually looks really good right now in comparison to the Patrick Mahomes contract. But anyway, the point being, you have to choose who you're going to spend your money on. The Niners had to trade away one of their best defensive players this year because he was up for a big contract and they didn't have the money to afford the big contract. They traded him away to the Indianapolis Colts, who were looking to rebuild their defensive line. The Colts gave a first-round draft pick for it because, quite frankly, DeForest Buckner was worth a first-round draft pick. He's a really good player. And the Colts had the ability to pay him what he wanted to be paid, and the Niners didn't. And the Niners went and drafted a replacement for him, which in many ways he may actually suit the defensive line better than what DeForest Buckner suited it. So, you know, you have these decisions that sometimes have to be made where a good player has to leave a team because they want more money than what the team can give them. But the upside of that is it does create a better opportunity for teams to catch up to other teams and have some parity with the other teams. You know what I mean? Be able to they can sometimes land the big player, the one difference maker making player, because they have the money to be able to do it if they haven't made poor decisions in the people that they pay. One of the things that helped the New England Patriots for many years is that Tom Brady was not, throughout the majority of his career, up until recently, he was like not even in the top 10 paid quarterbacks in the league.
Really?
He purposely took lower salaries to free up more money in the salary cap for the team to be able to hire other people. Well, I mean, if you look at it, this is a team that is always in the playoffs and has, what, 6 Super Bowl rings?
Right.
I mean,
it sounds like the right decision to me, because now you're able to afford a little bit.
You're making your team better by not being a greedy son of a bitch and taking all the money.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of that's kind of where the good decision making comes into effect, and you have to figure out how you're going to make a team work with the money that you
right.
give them, just instead of just having unlimited pockets to pay for everything. Well, the Niners are one of the Niners of the 80s are one of the major reasons that the salary cap was put into place, because that dynasty, there are people who will call me sacrilegious for saying it, but I will say it, that dynasty was made by the DeBartolo's pockets. The DeBartolo's had enough money to be able to pay the Niners what they wanted, mm-hmm. the players what they wanted, and the players got paid and they stayed on the team, and you have the dynasty that you have of five Super Bowls within a 17 year period. Four Super Bowls within the 80s itself.
Wow.
So you think about, you don't think that one family is going to have such an impact on two of the biggest cultural things from our childhood, malls and the 49ers. And yet this family was involved in both of those things. Just kind of a weird story. Two things you wouldn't think are connected, but, you know, the mall and the NFL, but connected enough by the DeBartolo family, in that these guys had a hand in both of these things happening and being the way that they are now. And again, the fact that DeBartolo Jr. hired Bill Walsh and made him the head coach and created the mythology of the West Coast offense and Joe Montana and Jerry Rice and what those eventually meant to football. I mean, you got to think about the fact, I mentioned Tom Brady. Tom Brady grew up as a 49ers fan. There's pictures of him wearing a Montana jersey. He was there at the catch game when Dwight Clark made the catch.
Yeah.
That, you know, kind of changed the fortunes of the 49ers forever.
Yeah.
He was there at the catch game. He wanted to play for the 49ers his entire college career, his entire life up until he got drafted for the Patriots. That's what he wanted to do, was be a 49er.
Wow.
And so, I mean, this is a guy who will go down probably as the greatest quarterback to ever play in the NFL. He's got the rings to be able to prove it. This guy was inspired by these 49ers. So many people were inspired by the 49ers of the 80s to become players, by the various players or whatever, the team itself. They were inspired to become football players, and they're playing football today or have played football already. And that's the thing is, this is, you know, the Niners are undisputably the team of the 80s, but they changed the way that offense is run. They changed the coaches that ended up getting hired, and they changed the way that players are paid with the salary cap.
That's
all
crazy.
All because of this one family and what this one family was involved in.
That's crazy.
And how did this family get that money? Again, build in malls.
That's nuts. That's great, man.
I mean, then he can also take it to the fact that, you know, does Kevin Smith's career take off if he just does cloaks and doesn't do mall rats? Maybe mall rats owes something to the DeBartolo family. It'd be interesting to see if the Eden Prairie Mall, where they filmed it, was which part of it, if any part of it, was made by the DeBartolo family, or which part they may have owned. Maybe Kevin knows something to them as well. So, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, it's really funny to see how one family can have such an impact on our culture and on
yeah.
our country.
Man, that is...
And not necessarily an entirely negative impact.
Yeah, no. No, that's, I mean, that's small world, I guess, right?
So, anyway, I hope that was a nice education for people, especially the 49er fans out there. If you're not a 49er fan, suck it. You had to listen about the 49ers. And you'll have to listen about them more.
Don't worry, they'll come up again.
Yeah, oh, yeah. When don't they? Football season may come. I don't even know if we're going to have a football season this year. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
It's just like, will it happen? Won't it happen? It's a little frustrating only because the Niners are finally good again, and they may not get to have a season. And it's like, damn it. They retained like the majority of their players from going to the Super Bowl. And they probably shouldn't have even gotten to the Super Bowl this last year, because they were still in the rebuild phase. And it was only mm-hmm. the first year that Garoppolo was actually the quarterback in the system playing a whole year. And yet they did what they did. I was so looking forward to, like, if he did that after 1 year, these guys are going to get refined even more. They drafted some really good people to fill the few holes that they did have. The rest of it all is all coming back and going to be maybe healthy and better. And it's like, oh my God, are we going to see something really good this year? I'm just so glad that we're competitive, that we actually made it to playoffs and crap. And then we're not going to have football. It's like, seriously, I've been waiting for so long for my team to be good again. Patiently waiting, still rooting for my team, still wearing my colors, because if you're dedicated to your team, you stay dedicated to your team. Even if you are a Cleveland Browns fan or a Cincinnati Bengals fan, your team suck, but you should still be dedicated to them, damn it. Still give them that dedication. If you gave it to them originally, they still deserve it, okay?
Fair point. Fair point.
If you're a Raiders fan, something just went wrong with your childhood, and I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh.
I'll stand by that one 100%.
I'm sure you will.
Oh yeah, even to the Raiders fans, right to them. but I mean, yeah, you know, I've always been dedicated. I've never forsaken my team. But damn it, they were just starting to get good again. Just starting to get fun to watch them, where you think, yeah, we can win this game. I mean, I'm not saying we will, but we can. Whereas for a couple of years, it was like, nope, we're not going to win this game. Nope, we're not going to win this game. Oh, it looks like we're winning this game. I bet you they figure out a way to lose it. No, they're not. It's like, great, but no, we may not have a season. Damn it. I mean, honestly, it's pretty petty for me to think about that when there are people dying, because there are people dying. But at the same time, it does suck a little bit. Not as much as dying, but it does suck a little bit. But yeah. So anyway,
Nice full circle. I like that.
I hope we educated you on some interesting factoids about malls and the 49ers. Mike's going to have fun coming up with a title for this episode.
Yeah.
it's like, malls and 49ers, what am I going to do? But it is funny to know about this, and most people don't. Unless you're a fan of the 49ers hardcore, you don't even know who the DeBartolo family is. Or unless you're like really into mall construction, then you might know who the DeBartolo family is.
Which, I mean, there's probably somebody out there that's into that.
Actually, I will say this much.
So let us know if you're a mall construction enthusiast.
Well, the people that are involved in the construction industry, in the big construction industry, that have big businesses that do large construction projects, those people know who the other ones are. Yeah. And in fact, that's very evident when Eddie DeBartolo, like Junior, like I said, he was kind of kicked out of being an NFL owner because of some gambling issues he got into. He was convicted of crimes as a result of it. And just within the last year and a half, 2 years, he was actually pardoned for his crimes.
Whoa. Wow.
That's a hell of a story. He actually received a presidential pardon for his crimes.
Oh, I remember hearing about this.
Which is not surprising when you consider the fact that the president was involved in business, specifically in major construction business,
before
he was elected president. And so I am fairly certain that he is quite familiar with the DeBartolo family.
That would make sense.
That would give good reason as to why he would give DeBartolo a pardon when DeBartolo requested it.
Whoa.
It actually makes a lot of sense in that. Because, again, people who are in the industry, they know other people in the industry.
Because the names are
big and the names are important. But anyway.
Dude.
Thank you all for listening. And, Mike, where can people find us? Although they're already listening, but still, where can they find us?
Well, if you're listening to us, you're probably on our site, thezenchronicles.com or zenchron.com, spelled X-E-N-C-H-R-O-N. Or you're listening to us on one of the many available audio streaming podcast services. We're on Spotify. We're on TuneIn. We're on Google. We're on Apple. We're on – is that all? No, there's another one. I always miss one of them.
No, I think you got them all this time, actually.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah.
Nice job.
We're on all of those. We are also on our – we also have a channel. Blah, 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 blah. We also have a channel on our YouTube on YouTube. We have a YouTube page. Just search The Zenial Chronicles on YouTube, and you can get our entire archive. And from there, I would suggest, if you could, hit the subscribe button, click the bell icon so that you get notified the next podcast we come out with, and please leave a comment too, because we respond to comments. We'll talk about your comments on air. We'll do all that kind of fun stuff. And
unless you're a bot, we don't like bots.
Mm-mm, no, we will not respond to bots.
I feel the need to keep saying that all the time.
Yeah, we don't negotiate with bots.
And also keep in mind, if you're on our YouTube page, checking out our YouTube page, there's a couple other YouTube pages you can go to. You can check out Ruling Note Music, right? Did I say that one right?
Yes, thank you. Yes.
Check out Ruling Note Music, which is Mike's musical education show that he's doing. He recently got to do a little bit of an interview with a... What would you call them? A mashup?
They are
not really a parody band, but they're a
actually get into that. There's a really cool story about the name of the band. Yes. The name of the band I'm talking about, I'm working on a video for them right now. They're called Beatallica, which is a mashup of essentially the Beatles music and Metallica's music all in one band. Yeah.
So if you want to hear about how this mashup works, find Ruling Note Music and follow that. That video will be forthcoming.
Yeah.
And then you recently started with your wife a new video service on or a new video page on YouTube. What's this one called again?
That one is called Chronisode Games. So what we do is we play video games essentially, right? But we play them in the order of what is called, like, the established timeline order. So imagine if you were watching the Star Wars films and you actually started on episode 1 rather than starting on episode 4, which is release order. So okay, think about it that way. Again,
you're doing it in the actual chronological story order as opposed to the order of when the games came out.
Exactly.
So that you can try to get you're trying to convey the story through the gameplay. And people are watching the gameplay and you and your wife talking over the gameplay, right?
Yeah, pretty much. We're just kind of commentary, and we talk about like video game lore and that kind of stuff that helps you kind of round out the experience that you're having, because a lot of the times the game experiences are one small experience in a larger story, but a lot of the games are intertwined with each other. So we talk about that, and we talk about theories and that kind of fun stuff too. So thank you, Fantastic. James. Thanks for throwing that out there.
Well, I figure if people are already going to be on YouTube checking out one thing, why not check out a couple of other things that might be interesting? Maybe you're not into learning about different music things. I know on the Ruling Note, Mike teaches you some recording. He has some recording tips for you. He teaches you about different musical things. There was an episode on the Beach Boys and their connection to Charles Manson.
Yeah.
There's again this Beatallica episode coming out where he's teaching you about kind of some of the history of different musical things. Plus, again, some more recording tips and playing music at home type tips that I'm sure will be coming from this. If that interests you, check out the Ruling Note. If it doesn't, don't check out the Ruling Note. If video games interest you, check out. I cannot remember this one to say it. What is it again?
Chronisode Games.
I will never get that right. But if you're into video games, check that out and, you know, subscribe, click the bell, all the things, either one of those, whichever one of those things that you're interested in. Again, if you're already on YouTube, check them out. If you already like listening to Mike talk, sadly, you don't get to listen to me talk on either one of those things. I'm sorry.
It's okay. We might bring Mike you in on one or two of them, man. You're going to have to teach me how to play Halo.
I will be more than glad to do what I can to teach you how to play Halo. I love it, but I'm not necessarily that good with it. But it's still one of my favorite games.
Right.
But still, check it out. We want to make sure that you get whatever content you can, especially right now when we're all still stuck at home as much as we are. Stuff that you can watch. And again, if you enjoy listening to the things that Mike says, these are two more things that Mike is doing a whole bunch of talking about. So please check them out if you're on our YouTube. Even if you're not, go check them out anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to us, and we will be back again with more information for you next week.
Y'all have a good one.
Thank you for tuning in, friends. The journey continues next week.